mutated body. And this may be the last time I talk about slugs for a while, so an apologies to those of you who've heard it before. Or in a previous iteration, rather. So if you've never done any gardening, you might be inclined to believe the fable told by certain social scientists, humanities scholars, RSPB wildlife campaigns, and garden commentators that the garden is a place of sensory enchantment, a retreat, a paradise, a place of reflection, calm, and serenity, that gardening is the very best of human-non-human partnership, a place where life and land is co-produced. Of course, if you have actually done any gardening, or, like me, spent time hanging out with gardeners in London, Lisbon, Edinburgh, and now Madagascar, you will know that that fable doesn't hold up to much scrutiny. Gardening, for one, really isn't about material interaction and co-relation between beings. Rather, since the beings of gardening are never fully formed, there is always something outside relationships in the garden, beings to come. Gardening is about knowing and caring for the future possibilities of becoming at least as much as it is about caring for individual beings right there in front of you. Gardening requires that space and time be held open so that a creature, valued plants, might grow into them. Thus, the gardener's relationship is less with a completed, tangible, material plant and much more with the virtual time space of the possibility of a plant. So they relate not just to the being, but they anticipate the arrival of the being, and they are hospitable to its possible appearance. This means that the gardeners meet plants as four-dimensional beings: height, width, depth, but also temporality. Gardening, as this is implying, is anticipatory. And this anticipatory practice operates in a space of certain uncertainty, as even the most skilled plant grower must contend with unpredictable cycles of pest populations, weather, and of course the capricious individualism of plants. Of course, anticipation is a wider hallmark of our current crisis-saturated geologic, geopolitical, and geoeconomic moment, the moment in which risk horizons of the future pervade the present in ever more fretful, anxiety-provoking ways. The future has in fact never been so big. But for gardeners, anticipating this future is pleasurable. Anticipation involves a yearning to know what might happen, how this plant will grow today, this month, this season, and how can I channel the energies of the living and those to come, shaping, sculpting, carving, and cutting into the very stuff of the world. Anticipation in the garden thus means coaxing the future into being and caring for it. But of course, care has edges that cut more than one way. Not merely creative, worlding means prioritizing one possible world over another. Worlding, which I think gardening is an example of, has a constitutive violence. Making a good multi-species community requires not making another one that might exist otherwise. More prosaically, getting life to flourish in the garden requires killing. Thus, the true gardener must be brutal, as well as imaginative for the future. Mollusks, the phylum, they're the second largest number of species, are creatures with cryptic behaviors, often living in the dark, underwater, or fleeing at human vibrations. In fact, we've only had one mollusk, I think, so far. This was yesterday, the picture of the giant squid. Actually, no, that's no longer the bigger mollusk. They found an even bigger squid, bigger than the giant squid. I can't remember, what was it called?
Colossal squid,
that's the one. Gastropods, like slugs, and their snail kin make up the bulk of the mollusk phylum. No face, no hands, no hearing, rudimentary eyes, few points of similarity with mammals. Their life world is dominated by the play of moisture, dry, light, dark. Their body is long, creeping, fodder for monstrous nightmares. Slugs dwell in close proximity to most humans in the British Isles, feasting on paper in recycling bins in the morning, dining on lettuces by moonlight. Slugs are writers of domestic landscapes, leaving trails of mucus on carpet and stone. Readers, too, following the marks laid down by their kin in search of food, sex, and shelter. Indeed, the success of snails and slugs in post-glacial Britain was due in no small part to the spread of human settlement. Their population densities remain highest in disturbed landscapes like pasture and arable land. The slug was also offered a new niche by the massive suburban expansion in England and Wales of the 1930s, in which 4 million homes were built around London alone, almost all with outside space for a garden, leading to what the Royal Horticultural Society then called a plague of pestiferousness. And what was thereto called the black field slug was renamed the garden slug. Since then, the number of slug species in Britain has grown steadily, now reached 44, up from about 1400 years ago, thanks to the internationalisation of horticulture. Suburban garden, of course, offers slugs an ideal habitat, refuge in winter, shelter from predators, abundant food. And in a wet British spring, slug numbers can top 15 billion, and the average suburban garden can be home to about 200, each of which can munch through about 800 grams of plant material a year. Siggy, who is a gardener who lives in North London, described a formative slug encounter. "I planted my own runner beans," she said. "I grew them from little beans, loved and cared for them up here in the flat. They were really big. I was very happy. Then I go in the evening and the runner bean was covered in slugs. It was a tree of slugs. It was the most disgusting thing I've ever seen." And Annette, another gardener, this time in southeast London. "Oh, murder they are. Well, we've had in the compost bin and nowhere else slugs this long and that thick. When you try and pull them off anything, their slime is so bad it sticks to your fingers and you can't get it off with soap and water. They're incredible. I don't know how they know about the compost bin, but they do." I think that technically might be bigger than a mouse. Other gardeners showed me where slugs abseiled a foot or more on cords of mucus from a retaining wall. A few were avid fans of the leopard slug Limax maximus, in particular its sex lives, with a pair wrap themselves in mucus and use a thick thread to hang suspended in the air in unsanctioned suburban bondage. To successfully garden, gardeners must get to know slug behaviour. They must learn to read slime trails, to anticipate how slugs might react to humidity or rain, to distinguish between the scavenging Arion ater, the big black ones, and the more destructive, smaller critters, to become familiar with their breeding grounds and hidey holes and their traces. This is done reluctantly. Unlike, say, the conservation biologist or the animal geographer, gardeners don't want to find signs of slug presence. They don't want to meet this other species. Gardeners may not like slugs. They may find them disgusting, yet they know they are tied together, sticky not just with slime, but with their inherited histories and competing priorities for flourishing in the garden. The gardener also knows that inaction is not possible. Ignoring slugs is not an option. Implacable, indefatigable, slugs set parameters within which your garden can grow. Thus, Siggy, who I quoted just before, can't really just be struck by disgust and loathing at the tree of slugs. If the garden, as I began by saying, is about summoning certain forms of life and letting them flourish, then the slug contests that process in several ways. By eating plants, yes, but also by its ever-present threat, lurking, ready to unsettle any feeling of security or achievement. To bring beings into presence in gardening requires that some things must die. True conceptually, as I said earlier, in that bringing something to presence is a violent act of exclusion, prioritizing one possible world over another, but also practically in that the gardener must attack, not retreat. So let's return to Siggy. recalling that she was upset by that tree of slugs. In response, she laid down some pellets. I tried to use pellets, but I don't want to. Come back to that in a moment, it's quite telling. I mean, I hate those bloody slugs, but they're really dying a horrible death, like disgusting. I just said, no, okay, they can just live there and I'll try to grow plants, which hopefully they don't eat. I think they eat a lot. They even started to eat my geraniums, bastards. Geraniums are the classic plant that you're told to grow if you've got a big slug problem, because slugs are supposedly not meant to like them. So the disgust has shifted slightly here from the tree of slugs to the horrible death. She doesn't bother to ask whether a gastropod without a brain can feel pain. She's generous to the slug's lack, deciding not to use pellets again, but to change what plants she grows. Here's Linda, who dislikes treading on slugs or snails, but doesn't mind picking them up and dispatching them down the loo. I know one day I find 60, haha. I'm afraid I don't do anything terribly, what's the word, good with them. I put them down the toilet usually. We've got an outside loo here, so I find that's the easiest way I can't tread on them. Clearly, Linda has no actual qualms about killing slugs. But while she may not admit guilt, she knows she isn't innocent either. Why she says she is afraid. She doesn't do anything good with them. Her words and her hesitancy show her distancing herself from her actions. She uses humor in particular to maintain a gap between her finding of 60 slugs and killing them. Again, these questions sort of struggle to capture the black humor that pervaded all of our conversations about slugs. And she finds 60 in one day, which suggests that the slugs' sheer powers of proliferation negate any possibility for encounter or care. Tom, who's the last gardener I'm going to talk about, described a symptomatic reaction. So Tom had moved to southwest London after retiring from what he called a riotous lifestyle in Hackney. So he'd only started gardening a few years previously, and he recounted his neighbours, he lived in a little cul-de-sac, and he recounted his incredulity, or his neighbour's incredulity, as he tore up his patio car parking space in order to make room for more plants. None of his neighbours understood why. And he told me that he bought bedding plants in the first year and they just got eaten by the slugs because there are so many. I put down some pellets, some slug-killing stuff, and I just, after I saw what happened, I thought I'm never going to use that again. Actually, before this quote, he tells me that it is his mum who tells him to do this. And now I really can't believe that I did it. I just decided, no, I'll grow things that they won't eat. I'll collect coffee grinds, because I know they don't like crawling over that. I've dug both ponds, and I know the frogs might eat the slugs, so everything seems to be getting in balance, really. Sort of conjuring it. Let's not be too critical. A nice image of balance of nature. And I felt really bad about it, so I'll never do it again. And this sense of guilt, of regret, is mirrored in wider gardening culture, where surveys show that 80% of gardeners use slug pellets, but only 32% want to do so. A popular slug book notes that slugs are public enemy number one in gardens, and people spend most of their free time, quote, devising strategies to bring about the demise of these unwelcome gastropod guests. Note the indirect language. We bring about the demise, we do not kill. Over the last 20 years, gardeners have supposedly become more enlightened. The evils of chemicals now well known, people more careful, targeted, and thoughtful in how they kill pests. As B&Q salesman Alan Titchmarsh has it, most gardeners, if they are not actively green, do at least feel a pricking of conscience whenever they reach for a sprayer. So this putatively enlightened, benign gardener now has a huge array of natural or organic coping strategies and controls. Copper rings, copper salts, coffee grounds, sharp edges, nematodes, fence tossing, deer traps, the scissor snip, frog houses, eco-friendly pellets, hedgehogs, gathering slugs in a bag and relocating them to the local park. All of these designed to create a distance between species. Siggy, Linda, and Tom use two tactics to deal with slugs. They kill, but their killing is wrapped up in this weird sense of guilt or reluctance. They also create a space where slugs won't meet plants, or at least they hope they won't meet. If connections with slugs are unpleasant, and if their activities interfere in the relations between a gardener, their plants, and their imagination, then one aim of gardeners is not merely to detach themselves from slugs, but not to have to ever meet in the first place. Gardening here switches from being a dream of presence to a fantasy of absence, or hoped for absence. The aim of this fantasy work is to make insensible the slug, creating a space into which privileged life might grow, but in which the monstrous slug is not met, or where it will die unheeded. Some concluding thoughts. What is happening when the gardener and the slug touch, or when they don't touch, but the slug is killed, excluded, loathed? Firstly, this isn't about killing well. Haraway's injunction to avoid one's mortal entanglements and one's necessary killing practices. Gardner's practices of killing speak more of a strange guilt about death, and the sheer numbers of ways that they kill says as much about innovation, I had to get that word in this talk, innovation in the gardening sector as it does about their ethics. It's more about minimizing killing by reordering plants and distancing oneself from the necessities of stewardship, not inhabiting killing better. Second, the biopolitical exchange here is less about sacrificing life for life, but more about managing life for dreams of life to come. So we're closer to a good biopolitics, where life's creativity always subverts its orderings. Slugs exceed the control of the gardener. Their knowledge is insufficient to manage slugs. Where are the slugs anyway? Why do they lurk in the compost bin? Will it be a wet spring? Slugs do more than just chomp on plants in annoying ways. Slugs make flourishing more awkward by increasing uncertainty in how gardeners anticipate future plant growth. Thirdly, and finally, my biggest point, is that this isn't an ethics being sparked between species meeting or from relating. More than human ethics has urged us to stick close to the action rather than to cleave to universal principles or preformed procedures for ethics, arguing that it is amid the practices of living with that accountability, caring for, and responsibility matter. Virtues to be cultivated in this are being open, conviviality, sharing, being experimental, seeing the absence of a quality like brain, ear, or eye as something other than a privation, and finally recognizing that I am always given over to the other. The model in this is one of contagion, as Catherine Yusoff has argued, where a regard and care for the other emerges from encounters with vital, vibrant others. Interspecies meetings, even the disgusting ones, come with the promise of changing our sense of the possible and the good. The slug, I think, shows the limit to this way of thinking about ethics. I did this morning, and something inside me always dies when I see one of these tables, but I find it quite helpful this time. Lingering behind this more than human ethic is a desire to affirm a certain ontology, on the left, of connection, flow, attachment, co-becoming. There has, of course, never been any particular reason why such an ontology leads to any kind of ethics. The hoary naturalistic fallacy rears its head here. No necessary reason why an ontology of connection should give better ethics than one of dualism. An ethics of encounter casts maneuvers to detach oneself from the world or from certain of the world's inhabitants as a move in the wrong direction. But really, if we're saying that ethics can arrive from the left-hand side, there's no reason why they can't arrive from the right-hand side. Or better, I think, from the play of both. I wouldn't want to imply a whole new set of dualisms here. That's one of the downsides of these kind of table. Detachment here isn't a negation, but a constituent externality of attachment. In practice, detachment doesn't affirm a gulf of separation, indifference, or cold retreat from the other. Although forms of attachment and detachment can curtail or truncate one another, they also extend one another and make one another possible, to quote Bate Kanté, anthropologist. So one way forward, I think, might be to make room for a new ethics of detachment that could sometimes work around, sometimes in parallel, sometimes antecedent to or after the relation and practices of relating. I think we need a looser mapping of ontology and ethics, because even as the left-hand side, which is broadly the relational diagnostic, has brought specific forms of recognition, cohabitation, and care into view, it has also, as a growing number of authors point out, tended to ignore the non-relational, what may not be vital, and what may precede or be obscured by existing relations. For any practice of relation has a constitutive violence, it is also an exclusion, prioritizing one possible connection over another, and to ensure it lasts, it may involve the subjugation or death of outside others, especially those monstrous, unloved, slimy ones. Thus mixing the left and right columns, rather than just are being relegated, or just being related, points to an ethics that might avoid the violence of relation, encompass the unwanted and unloved, and remain open to alterity, to learn to acknowledge that space between relation, when we encounter the other, but sense that we are ultimately not sticky with them, but separate. That's it.
Turn this off.